I am pleased to welcome to this show one of the most compelling and interesting commentators on national and international events that I know. Ian Bremmer is the founder and president of the Eurasia Group, a political risk and research firm. He's also the founder of G-Zero Media, a digital media firm with a daily newsletter I always take the time to read. Full disclosure, my daughter Natalie is the deputy director of content at G-Zero. In the days after the nation has celebrated our 250th anniversary, I've invited Ian to join us to reflect on where we are as a nation, where we've been, and where we are going for the next 250 years. Ian, thank you for joining WBGO, and thank you for your time.
Hey, Jay, it's really good to see you again.
So I just returned a few days ago from the Aspen Ideas Festival, where I saw Fareed Zakaria interviewing Ken Burns about his recent documentary about the American Revolution. And Ken Burns put it in terms of a birth 1.0, a rebirth 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. You could say 2.0 was women's suffrage, 3.0 was the American Civil Rights Movement, and presumably there will be a 4.0, 5.0, 6.0 in terms of the dedication, rededication to our democracy. I do want to focus in for the moment on our current president. We have a president who breaks all the rules and norms, pushes and often exceeds legal and constitutional norms, offends our international allies, launched an ill-conceived and illegal war against Iran that cost Americans billions at the gas pump, and is literally taking a wrecking ball to the White House. Yet he continues to enjoy the hardcore support of a large percentage of American voters. We elected Donald Trump president not once, but twice. So, in your observation, why is that? I always like to ask about underlying currents in our democracy. Why did we elect Donald Trump twice?
Well, grievance is a big part of it. I think that when a lot of Americans feel that the powers that be, whether establishment, Democrat or Republican, or the so-called deep state, administrative state, bureaucracy, elites, bankers, professors, you know, corporate CEOs, media types, I mean, all of these folks, of whom you and I occupy a few, you know, sort of concentric circles too,
yep.
That they've done real well for themselves and had access to power, but that a whole bunch of other Americans were left behind, weren't cared about. And when you feel like the institutions are becoming illegitimate, when you feel like rule of law applies to a certain subset of privileged people, but not to others, including you and your family, then you're willing to vote for things and support things, and sometimes you're willing to do much more radical things in favor of people that will blow up or at least disrupt the existing system. And that's exactly what Trump said he would do. He was a fist in the face of the fake news media, as he liked to call it, and to not only the Democratic Party, but to much of the Republican Party as well. And you see what he's willing to do to Republicans that dare not to be fully loyal to him. And, you know, you say not once, but twice he was elected. And the second time, of course, he got the popular vote. Now, I do think that Biden and Kamala deserve some of the credit for having held on to power far too long and frankly, misrepresented Biden's health to the American people. But leaving that aside, when Trump is indicted and convicted, and then when he's almost assassinated, I mean, all of those things fuel that sense of grievance. And unfortunately, final point is that the fact that he has done nothing to actually help so many of the people that he is supposed to be put into place to be in service of. This is not a president who is does service. It's not a president who thinks about anything beyond himself. So it's unfortunate, truly unfortunate, that that sense of grievance has not been put in service of something in any way constructive and productive, because we do need to fix so many of the things that Trump voters are angry about. But unfortunately, Trump is not the guy to do those things.
Reflecting on the national mood, I have to believe that what you've just described about the national mood did not exist to a very large extent, say, in the post-World War II period or in the early 1960s when we elected John F. Kennedy president. Are there major milestones or turning points in your assessment that has led to where we are now in terms of the attitude you just described?
Yeah, I would call them overdetermined. I think there's so many things that have happened over the past, say, 30, 40 years, that it would be very surprising if you didn't have this kind of a backlash, whether from the far left or the far right, and whether from someone that would be an effective political revolutionary, or an undisciplined, incompetent one. You'd focus on, all of the support for free trade that led to displacement of working and middle class labor for cheaper labor in China and India and other countries, in both manufacturing jobs, also service jobs, without the training and the redistribution of wealth to help ensure that those people don't feel substitutable. You'd look at the fairly open and permissive immigration rules, both for legal immigration and turning a blind eye to illegal immigration and the corporates that have benefited mightily from that, while those that have been in the US for a longer period of time feel like they're not being taken care of. You could look at the progressive elements in urban elites and particularly universities, and the identity politics that led to excesses in DEI and wokeism, which at a time that especially undereducated men felt like they could be made fun of. They were the one group that you could discriminate against with impunity, but you'd be canceled if you said that about a black person or a woman, or a gay person or a disabled person or what have you. And then, of course, we have all of this being expanded by the corporatization, the segmentization of media, with algorithms all targeting individuals to listen to and engage with things they already in principle agree with. So losing all of that civic fabric that you and I try to bring to our public voices. But I mean, we aren't in the Walter Cronkite world anymore. We're
All
in the
right.
Tucker Carlson, Rachel Maddow world, and a whole bunch of much more abstruse and targeted TikTok influencers or YouTube influencers that most of the listeners to this show probably haven't even heard of.
Tucker Carlson and Rachel Maddow would probably both be offended to know that they're wind up in the same sentence someplace. But so you just
Maybe
touched on
not
something.
anymore. Tucker's, Tucker, now that Tucker's flipped away from the Republicans,
That's
supposedly.
true. Well, so that's interesting. So you touched on something. What to what extent does the environment you've just described exist because of media today, because of media, social media, cable news. Is it, are our sources for news contributing to the attitudes that you've just explained?
I mean, sure, if you follow Elon Musk, then you know, and he's owns one of the more important platforms out there. What he is promoting himself, and the accounts that he is algorithmically supporting, that he is personally reposting, are very far from the civic values, engagement, communitarianism, and patriotism that our founders stood for. And he's one example, a particularly powerful one. He's almost a trillionaire. But there are many, many others. And you know, look, I'm not a believer in punching down. I generally think that it, you know, the people that are most accountable and responsible for outcomes are the ones that have the most power to do something about it. And that means that the accountability for you and me is greater than it is for a lot of folks that are feeling that grievance. But it's that, but also that someone like Elon or Zuck are or Trump are much more responsible for the situation we're in right now. And let's remember, Trump owns a social media network too. Of course he does. Truth Social. And he does most of his posting on that.
So it sounds as though most of what you've described about, MAGA, Trumpism, whatever you want to call it, is more cultural than political, which I think is why so many people have difficulty placing MAGA supporters in any particular place on a traditional political spectrum. Isn't that right?
Well, I mean, when it comes to MAGA itself, I think it's about really a personality cult for Trump. Is that cultural? I mean, you know, he is a uniquely id-driven, charismatic leader, and whatever he happens to say, he supports at a given moment, and those things can flip very quickly, like we saw with the Epstein files, for example. His supporters will be with him because they have decided that opposing him on any issue, no matter how stupid, is something that is going to only provide weight to his opponents, his political opponents. And so they choose not to do that, whether it's the war in Iran, or whether it's taking over Greenland. I mean, you know, you and I can focus on things that are objectively stupid, that should not get more than 5 or 10% of the approval of any constituency. And yet Trump can reliably count on his MAGA supporters to back him on that. That has very little to do with the issue. So to say that that's cultural or political, I don't know that I would define it in either way when we're talking about Trump, because I think it's a loyalty to him, which then raises the question, once Trump is gone, because he will be in short order, where is the future of that grievance? And some of it will be on the right, and some of it will be on the left. I suspect it will be more economic and cultural than it will be political. But and what I mean by that is, like, I think there's going to be a lot more anti-AI and tech lash coming from the left, and maybe attracting some crossover from the right than we saw, for example, with what Trump was driving in 2016 and 2020 and 2024.
I tell my Democratic friends, if you want to really understand where we are politically, go talk to the person who voted for Bernie Sanders and then figured out a way to vote for Donald Trump in the same election cycle or in the same couple of years.
Yeah, it's not their Israel-Palestine position. That's pretty clear.
Someone will almost certainly try to inherit the MAGA movement in the next presidential election cycle. So I've been a proponent of the view for a long time that there is a pendulum theory to American politics. And if you look at history up until recently, every 16 years, we elect a next gen new president. 1960, Kennedy. 76, Carter, after Nixon Ford. 92, after Reagan Bush. And then, of course, Obama in 08. And then, of course, we had, 24 should have been that next election, that next turn. But we had, Trump, then Biden. Biden steps out and Trump beats Harris. But do you agree with my assessment, or is this current political landscape sort of a new normal for us?
Look, I spend a lot of time looking at Latin American elections, and I mean, you can almost guarantee the pendulum that whatever you just had, they're going to throw out and they're going to go far in the other direction.
Right.
It's Colombia, it's Brazil, it's Mexico, it's all, it's everywhere, right? I'm sure that they were going to have a pendulum swing like that in the United States at some point, but I also know that in 2028, at this point, anyone that wins a primary has a shot at winning the presidency because the country is so divided, and because there are so few votes that are truly, truly up for grabs. Now, it was interesting when Tucker said he's not going to run as a Republican. That made life pretty interesting because running as a third party is a really hard thing to do in the United States. Because I would have said that Tucker was in a pretty good position to actually inherit a lot of MAGA, because Tucker is saying a lot of things that J.D. Vance would like to say if he wasn't being Kamala Harris to Trump, right? I mean,
Right.
Tucker has gone full anti-Israel, full anti-forever wars. He's gone a big anti-corruption. Big on Epstein. He's embracing a lot of conspiracy theories. I mean, this is like, Trump without the self-enrichment, the self-dealing, and the capture by all the billionaires. And and Tucker also is a pretty extraordinary retail talent. You meet him, he's got a big following, and he's very charismatic one-on-one. I would not vote for him. I believe he's a fabulist, and promotes the worst kind of consistent conspiracies, not to mention a lot of hatred and sowing division. But I also recognize that there is space for someone like that in this divided environment. On the left, it does seem to me that most of the momentum right now is on the progressive side of that party. It's with the Democratic Socialists. It's with the Mamdanis and the people that he is inspiring. I don't know many people you're in my age that voted for Mamdani. I know a few, but almost everyone I know in New York that's under 35 voted for Mamdani. And that's now, granted, young people don't vote a lot in this country, but still, that's saying something. And that implies, I mean, there'll be 25 people running on the Democratic side. That implies that you're going to bet more on the AOCs than you would bet on people that you and I know very well, like Rahm Emanuel, for example.
Yeah, that's I actually believe that's going to be the essential choice for Democratic primary voters in 28. Do you want the pragmatist who has the experience, who says, I know how to get stuff done, versus the more inspirational younger candidate?
What do
You
you think
wrote,
is the right thing for people to do, Jay? What's your view?
I was in, I live in northern New Jersey, but I was inspired by Mamdani because I saw the way in which he motivated and inspired young people and brought them into the political process. And, when you're mayor of New York, you're not governing day to day on a political spectrum. You're focused on snow removal and police protection and things like that. And So I think he's good for the American political environment. I'm a hardcore pragmatist myself, hardcore moderate. I believe in getting stuff done. So I'll almost always opt for the person who knows how to get stuff done, versus somebody who can inspire and motivate, but then doesn't know how to work with a Congress. So, but that's my point of view. I've also believed for a long time, at least on the Democratic side, the successful candidate is someone who is fundamentally a moderate, but knows how to inspire the left. Think Clinton and Obama, for example. You wrote recently that you thought Trump was past his peak in terms of his political power. Why is that? Just is that just a natural progression toward being a lame duck, or what?
Well, I would make I feel much more confident in saying that on the global stage. He's now tried two really big things, and he's been massively constrained. The first was Liberation Day when he put the top higher tariffs than Americans have seen on the world in almost a century. And most importantly, against China, the Chinese stood up to him, hit him back, same tariffs in return, essentially became a boycott de facto, and said that they're going to shut down critical minerals for the United States. And they were essential. And when that happened, Trump had to back down. And then, of course, he's constrained by market responses. He's constrained by the Supreme Court and judicial responses knocking down IEPA and the rest. So that's on the global economic side. On the national security side, the biggest thing he's tried to do as president is the war in Iran. After a very successful but much smaller intervention in Venezuela. And here again, the Iranians hit him back hard by disrupting and shutting down the Strait of Hormuz. And Trump was forced to back down yet again. He had 15,000 troops. He was ready to take the oil, destroy the civilization, grab Karg Island. Didn't do any of those things and admitted, I don't want to be President Hoover. It was going to be an economic catastrophe. So from both of these cases, he was forced to back down. On Greenland, he was forced to back down. On Russia, Ukraine, the Ukrainians turns out have the cards. They're actually winning. So Trump has been backing down. So I think on the global stage, you now have real clear limits to what Trump is capable of actually doing, and leaders around the world that understand that, which was why Meloni, the only European leader that flew and actually showed up for his second inauguration, came out hitting against him hard when she took an insult from him, because his approval ratings in Italy is like 7%. And you're going to see more of that. I was in Vienna a week ago, saw the Austrian president who came out against Trump just as hard as Meloni did. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. So globally, I think that is clearly the case. He's past peak Trump in terms of disruption and impact. Domestically, it is a bit a more open question, but that more open question, the door or the window on that is clearly likely to close post November, given the overwhelming likelihood that the House flips to the Democrats. Senate probably stays Republican, but they lose seats. And then suddenly 80-year-old Trump starts looking like a lame duck as the new primary process begins, and as most of his supporters in office start recognizing that, hey, my political career is going to last a lot longer than this guy. So I got to figure out who I'm next going to hitch my wagon to. So I made that I came out and made that call, what, 2 weeks ago, I guess. But I feel that it's a pretty I'm pretty confident about it.
You do see Senate Republicans, inch by inch, feeling a little more courageous about taking him on. I personally believe, understanding somewhat about how the Senate works, that a major turning point for a lot of them was when Trump endorsed Paxton over Cornyn, who was very well liked in the Senate, part of the leadership. And he endorsed somebody who's probably less likely to get elected in Texas.
Well, the amazing thing, of course, is when he told the Georgian voters not to turn out because Georgia had been stolen against them. And as a consequence, he flips the Senate to the Democrats because he just doesn't care about his party.
I got to ask you about the AI revolution we're in the midst of right now. What are you telling people about how this fits in for middle America? I hate the phrase everyday voter or everyday American, but if I'm in the middle class in America, how should I be viewing the AI revolution? Should I be worried about losing my job, or what do you think?
In America, with the political system we presently have, I think you should be very worried. And Americans indeed are the most negative on AI, the most fearful of any large economy in the world. When they're asked, Canada's number two, while the Chinese and so much of the global South are much more enthusiastic. And that is a reflection of an enormous change in society and in US politics. Again, if you believe that the people with all the money and power are not looking out for you, and suddenly they're using AI to accumulate even more money and power, and that's why the economy and the stock market is doing so well. If you happen to be a shareholder in Starlink or in, you're part of the new SpaceX IPO, I should say, you're pretty happy. But if you're the average middle class American, of which there are an increasingly small number, you're saying these guys are going to use this to screw me. And I don't trust anything they're saying because all they're doing is talking their own book when they're on CNBC and Bloomberg. Now, I mean, I believe I look at my own firm and we've got 250 employees. And we've got a business model that easily could use 1,000 people. I would know how to deploy them. We just don't have money for 1,000 people. So everyone in my firm understands that you need to be using AI to essentially make you more capable so that we have a better shot of actually meeting that market demand. So in my firm, and a lot of these people, they're very well educated, but they're not all super wealthy. I mean, they're starting off as political scientists like I was 30, 35 years ago. I don't think they're scared. And I think they're using it very effectively. And I wish that's what I think the middle class in a political system that was less broken, I think the middle class in America would and should feel that this is an unprecedented opportunity because AI is going to drive extraordinary productivity gains. But that is not the way most Americans feel now. And they shouldn't feel that way now because they are living in a system that they are more likely to be taken advantage of.
That's interesting. You lead a global consulting firm. What do you tell your clients is the part of the world, the region of the world that we are most overlooking and doesn't get enough attention?
Well, the part of the world that doesn't get enough attention is Africa, because it is so young, its population is expanding, there are so many essential resources, all of these things, and it gets no attention. But that is not what I'm telling clients, and I'm not telling clients that, even though it's true, because they don't care. And they don't care because it's too long-term a play. It's too small a collective economy. And so it's very hard to get American or European or Canadian or Japanese corporates or financial institutions to do a lot in Africa. They're much more interested in what happens up to US-China relations. They're much more interested in opportunities in India. They're much more concerned about lack of opportunities in Europe and what it takes to at least continue to tread water in those economies that aren't really growing. And they're most excited still about the United States, which, despite all the political problems, is where the majority of the big of the opportunities at scale that where you have access continue to be.
Right. I noted in one of your recent newsletters that by 2050, one quarter of the people on this planet will be African.
African. Yep. And, absolutely. Because every other continent is no longer producing young people beyond replacement level. Right. And the Africans are.
I'm going to guess that 20, 30 years ago, people had the same attitude toward India. Now look where India is now.
20, 30 years ago, people thought India and China were both going to be, certainly 40 years ago, they mm-hmm. would have said India and China were both going to be the super rising giants. And mm-hmm. and it turned out that China was and India was not until Modi came to power. And only in the last 10 years is India now starting to become an exciting story. But the scale of those two things are wildly different. Wildly different.
Yes, right, right. Last question for me, Ian, which might be the hardest question to answer. Are America's best days, in your view, behind us or ahead of us?
I have no idea. But I know that
you're honest.
I know that there is no time that I would rather be alive, because there's been no time with so much extraordinary potential, and not just potential for me, but that so many Americans have the opportunity with the technologies that we have and we are developing to make real change, to be responsible for what this next iteration, 5.0, 6.0, whatever the next Ken Burns iteration is going to be, of the United States is going to be determined by a much, much larger number of Americans. And that's an exciting time to be alive. It's an exciting time to be one of the 8 billion on the planet, too. And, you know, I mean, I know we're talking about America's 250th, but I also recognize how arbitrary that is, in the sense that, you know, I was born here randomly by chance. And as, you know, someone that it's a great lottery ticket that I, you know, didn't deserve, and it gave me lots of opportunities. I'm very grateful, but I don't think that makes me any different or any better than any of the others that didn't have that. It's important for Americans to remember that too.
Okay. Got any favorite R&B artists? Classic R&B, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, Luther Vandross has to be number one for me. I really love everything he's done. And I'd probably say Bobby Caldwell would be number two. I listen to a lot, but those would be my go-tos.
Okay. Ian Bremmer, thank you for your time and for everything that you do.
Thanks, Jay. Great to see you, man.